From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is the fun-size version of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything. And asking your questions is the indisputable, honorable Joe Russo, producer Joe himself. How are you?
I'm doing well, Mick. I'm doing well. We have a new way for our fans to send us questions, not just through social media, but we have an Ask Mick Anything at Gmail email set up now.
Simpler than ever.
And also, I found our super postmodern fan, Gary Duffy, sent us some gift cards for pizza. So
and we know Joe lives on pizza.
We know Joe's veins run with pizza. So it was very much appreciated. And you know, if anyone else wants to send us gifts to our Ask Mick Anything,
don't do that, please.
No, it was very nice. It was very thoughtful. It was very funny. And it will definitely go to good use. But
thank you, Gary.
But other fans are sending us questions there, which is great. And we've culled some of those, and we culled some from social media, and we've got a good batch today, Mick.
Sounds great. Shall we dive in?
Let's do it. All right. Another postmortem super fan, Momo, asks,
oh dear,
Mick, what will you do when Joe is a famous Spielberg type director and no longer has time to produce Postmortem?
I will give him my highest congratulations, ask for a percentage, and give him nothing but my support.
I like that. The fun thing about Postmortem is we do it because we want to do it. Right?
Yeah, nobody's getting rich off of Postmortem.
No one is getting rich off Postmortem.
But where else do you get to have conversations with Stephen King and Clive Barker and John Carpenter and Guillermo del Toro and Whoopi Goldberg? And
yeah, I've gotten to meet my heroes through doing this, and I owe that opportunity to you, and it's been fun, and it really doesn't take a ton of my time outside of I'm still making movies. I'm in production on a movie right now, and here we are recording an AMA. Indeed. So yeah, we do it because we love it. And literally just our engineer, our post producer, Chris Price, said the same thing. We do this because we love it, not because we're out to get rich. So I imagine if I should be so lucky to become a Spielberg type, I'll still want to do this. It's pretty great.
Well, so. This is fun. I mean, we've been doing it. We're in our sixth year now. And not only is it a good time, we all learn something from every episode, but also it feels like we're doing something for the community. You know, we are bringing people in to open up about their process, about their creative lives in ways that I've never really seen or heard done on other platforms. And it's a very special thing for me. And it feels like we're leaving some accessible history in our wake.
I am very proud of the library of podcasts we have created, all 200 episodes of them plus.
Amazing.
You know, I will continue to do this as long as Mick wants to keep doing it. So yeah. I think that's the real question is,
till we run out of good guests.
That's right. That's right. And it hasn't happened yet.
Nope.
All right, Josh, AKA the Lord of Delusions, writes, First, thank you for your recent foray into the quality control on The Thing.
Oh, yes.
On the flip side of that controversy, there's been a lot of older films recently where the restoration and remastering have taken away from the overall feel and effect, changing the color palette and taking out the original grainy quality of the film The Evil Dead is a good example of subtraction by addition. Should not the original cut just be left alone to remain true to the film sometimes?
Well, they should certainly be made available. But if a director like Sam Raimi wants to go in, and Evil Dead was shot on 16 millimeter film and blown up to 35 for financial reasons. If he could have afforded to shoot it in 35 millimeter, or if digital filmmaking was available when the Evil Dead was made, he certainly would have availed himself of that. So if there's a way to take the best elements that make the film and present them in as perfect a manner as possible under the supervision and approval of the filmmaker himself, I'm all for that. You know, if when The Stand was shot on 16 millimeter film and broadcast in standard definition, that was the norm. We edited on videotape that was standard definition. It was never cut on film. And it took until a couple of years ago for them to actually go back to the negative and reprocess it and remaster it in high definition. And it looks better than it ever did. It looks as good as I intended it to look, but was not able to achieve in that way. So I am not necessarily one for just leaving what was alone if you can actually improve it. You know, the stereo surround sound and everything being digitized and enhanced, all of that stuff is really great. But yeah, you should have the original theatrical release available in its truest form, but let a filmmaker improve it if it's possible to bring the vision that he intended from the very beginning.
Yeah, and I remember you were really happy with that Stand restoration, and as you should be, it looks gorgeous. And
it's amazing. Yeah.
But I think specifically with a movie like The Evil Dead, part of the charm was kind of the low grade quality to some of the footage, you know?
Well, yeah, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you look at those movies and you think, what is going to happen here? These are not polished studio productions.
They feel dangerous.
They're artfully made, but right, they feel dangerous. You don't recognize the people in them. You don't recognize anything that you would from a Hollywood movie. It's without that polish, but it has an artistry of its own. And it makes the most of the tools that were available at the time for next to no money. And we applaud that. But I don't mind having a cleaned up version if it meets the filmmaker's approval and standards.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too is our technology and our home viewing technology has gotten so crystal clear and sharp that, maybe sometimes it makes sense to upgrade it just for the upgraded technology. Cause you know, I certainly know that sometimes when I look back on my older shorts that were shot on the early days of digital, you know, I kind of wish they looked a little better than they do, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Well, and I think Anchor Bay for years, if not decades, made their livings on different editions of Evil Dead and Halloween.
Yes,
must be at least 30 versions of all of those, of both of those movies.
Well, and which allowed them to finance such classic television shows as
the Masters of Horror series.
The Masters of Horror. So let's not fault them too much for it.
Oh, not at all.
All right. RBP writes, has the last 2 years provided you or producer Joe with many story ideas, whether COVID related or just pandemic related?
You know, I have kind of avoided that because even though it's lasting longer than anybody anticipated, it's still something transitory. I think if you do a COVID story today, it's going to be old by the time it comes out.
Yeah.
Its day has passed. It's marking a time in our history that is important and well worth marking. And if you have a story that pertains to that and it matters, that's great. There have been a couple of them that I've seen that are terrific. I don't really think in those terms. I, you know, everybody makes a movie for release today. They don't make a movie for 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to think in timeless terms and not for the immediacy of it, but something that will have some lasting power in case, like in the case of Nightmare Cinema, it came out a year or two after we shot it because of all those issues we had dealing with distribution and funding and all of that stuff.
But I do think there is something to some of the themes and ideas that we
well like Host is a genius work.
Well, sure, that is directly pandemic related. But I guess what I'm specifically saying is, you know, like rewatching The Thing for the 40th anniversary. You know, that actually is a perfect pandemic type movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Contained, we don't know who's infected. Could they infect you? You know, so I think there's a lot of ideas that have come out of the pandemic in terms of how society works, how we function as a society, how we treat each other as a society, that I think are very ripe themes and ideas that I'm certainly trying to explore in some of my writing now, that aren't necessarily like COVID specific. You right, know,
but COVID influenced, yeah.
COVID influenced, yes. And I think that's probably, I think over the next couple of years, especially, you know, in genres like horror and science fiction, which tend to deal with, you know, socio-political ideas at a thematic level, I think we'll see lots of interesting twists to this nightmare that we've been stuck in for 2+ years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing those because anything that's approached, anything that's done in an original and surprising way is exciting. And this is something that's happened to our society around the world that can't help but influence what comes after. But anything that's pandemic specific, I'm not particularly interested in writing or directing along those lines. But
yeah, no, I think those moments might have already passed. You know, Host was that lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, and there have been a couple others, names of which don't come to mind immediately, but Host is the most evident of them.
Yes, yes. I don't think in 3 years we're going to be super excited about watching Little Tiles on Zoom. But all right. Avid listener Jay Thomas writes, every project is designed from script to screen. Lens choices, lighting styles, lens filters all help create the final image. Mick, for one, worked through and got started during the big Amblin period. Was there any set filters or lighting styles designated to achieve the Amblin look that you're aware of? Orson Welles was said to lean towards a 25 millimeter for Citizen Kane. Do you both have certain influences, filters, or lens choices you tend to go back to or decide to use with specific projects?
I actually do. There was no Amblin workbook, you know, but it you couldn't help but be influenced by Steven Spielberg's work if you're writing and directing for Steven Spielberg. And the push-ins from below work so much better in a widescreen than in a 1.85. Those moving camera shots pushing into the faces filled with awe was very specific to his style. But for me, I like lenses that are really wide or really long. I don't like what the eye sees. I don't like a 35. This is getting very technical.
No, that's what he's asking.
I don't like 35 to 50 millimeter lenses for the most part. I'd rather shoot a close-up in a wide lens with the camera close to the actor or a long lens. Long lenses are only focused at, they have a very narrow focal point. And things in the foreground and things in the background are out of focus. And in building terror and tension in horror, that's a great, great tool to use. And wide lenses give you such an overwhelming sense of place and with slight distortion. I love a 10 to 14 millimeter lens for masters and moving masters, especially because of the feel you get. It's almost a 3D feel, but it's exaggerated. And really wide lenses just look beautiful to me. And I like seeing the world, but especially, and I like to have a wide lens near the floor, taking in the whole scenery, whether it's an interior or exterior, and a long lens moving is great. I also like practical lighting. I like using actual lamps on the set or location or the stage people walk to and away from, rather than having giant movie lights illuminating. So many films and television shows are overlit. These days, that's not so much a big deal because digital filmmaking is so much more flexible and requires so much less light than 35 millimeter did. But I've always loved natural light, or at least to look like natural light. You put a lamp on a table and have a bunch of people sitting around that table having a conversation, or there's a lamp overhead and the light bounces off of white papers that are on the table, so the light bounces up on the faces from below. It's a beautiful, beautiful effect, and it feels natural and genuine, and it doesn't have the sense of artificial that so much film and television does. So those are a few of the things that I like to use specifically and technically.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for a long lens because I just love the focal drop off. You know, I love being able to shift the different perspectives within the plane of focus, and I love characters walking in and out of soft focus and in the sharp focus. I don't know. There's a lot you can do with it. I've always been a sucker for it. From my filmmaking even to my photography, I'm always trying to get how can I get something to fall out of focus, you know, like that's my
and but, I love the use of color as well. You know, the color has so much to do with emotion. You know, the color clothing that you wear, or the walls, or, you know, doing here's an example of the first Amazing Stories episode that I directed, the only one I directed, Life on Death Row. It's in color, but there's no color to it. So it looks like black and white. You don't know what era it takes place in. I used old telephones, but you know, everything, it could be today, it could be 1935. You know, I wanted to make a very much a genre piece set in a prison with an unidentifiable time and place. And so all of the clothing and everything, people were wearing gray and you know, just very muted colors. So the color palette was very, very limited. And that was very specific to that story.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I would be remiss not just to probe a little further into the Amblin part of the question, because I do feel like some of your earlier work, like Critters and Psycho and Sleepwalkers and even The Stand, do kind of share a visual style with some of the Amblin movies, that Norman Rockwell Goes to Hell quality that we've talked about in the past. And then I do feel like it kind of takes a shift with The Shining in a different direction towards what you've been describing here. Do you think there was like a carryover influence from the Amblin era onto Mick's early work, or do you think that was just...
You can't come of age at that time as a filmmaker, especially working within the House of Amblin, and not be influenced by that. And I'm sure that's why I was hired for Critters 2, because the first Critters was very Spielbergian. I was actually working for Spielberg at the time, and they could get a writer and director come from the House of Spielberg into something that was rooted in a Spielbergian kind of influence. But yeah, it's also music was a big deal. The Amblin influence also was orchestral music, that at a time when, you know, in 1978, Halloween created a boon in electronic musical scores. Nobody could afford an orchestra. And here's Critters 2, this little $4 million movie that normally in 1988 would have had an electronic score. But I insisted, and we got a non-union orchestra, 40-piece orchestra under Nicholas Pike. That is a huge part of that Norman Rockwell Goes to Hell, where, you know, you have that grandiose music that fills the vision even more. But yeah, the whole use of moving camera was something that, you know, it's cheaper and easier and quicker to have static cameras, and a lot of genre movies at that time were either handheld or more static. But that graceful balletic camera movement that Spielberg was so good at, that John Carpenter really heightened with the Panaglide, you know, the Panavision version of Steadicam.
Yeah.
And those were very influential. The idea of a camera movement expressing emotional content is very important, to move into something or away from something or around something, or to reveal things with a glacial or balletic camera move. All those things were very much heightened when Amblin and the Spielberg films produced and directed by Steven were made. They really kind of created a new palette for filmmaking.
Yeah. One that I think you applied very well to your own work. So,
thank you.
And evolved into your own style. So
thank
there you.
You
go. Ash writes, I was just curious to know how your involvement in The Fly 2 came about. Was it a daunting task trying to make a sequel to one of the finest sci-fi horror movies of all time? I'm a huge fan of The Fly 2, and I think it's a really great movie in its own right that probably unfairly gets stuck in the shadow of the original, daring to progress the story, and it has some really great kick-ass gore, too.
Well, the way I got involved, basically, was my agent pitched me to the studio and Mel Brooks' company, Brooks Films. People don't realize that Mel Brooks produced The Fly movies under his company, with Stuart Kornfeld directly producing. I had a meeting and I had a take. It was at a time, this was in what, 1986, I think, I was in my Amblin world before I'd made my first movie. So I was just hired as a writer. And my knowledge and love for the Cronenberg film, as well as the Cronenberg canon, I think helped a lot. I had an original idea. That idea went by the wayside, however, during rewrites, when they wanted to make it more of a teenage monster movie. But yeah, I had known David for several years. I was a huge fan. He actually gave support to the idea of me writing the sequel, even though he wasn't involved in the movie. And very daunting, as The Fly, as our questioner mentioned, is one of the great horror movies, monster movies of all time. It's a very adult, very sophisticated, gooey monster movie. You
yes,
know,
it, is. Okay.
It has it gets as grotesque as any drive-in monster movie, but in the realm of a wonderful love story and a deeply character motivated story that's very human and very emotional. And I wanted to bring the integrity of that to The Fly 2. I wish I could be as enthusiastic about the movie that happened as our questioner, because I think it falls far short of what happened with David's movie. And I think it's mainly because there was a fight. Leonard Goldberg, who had been a TV producer, was briefly the head of 20th Century Fox when I was working on it. And Scott Rudin was the production executive, who's now, you know, a hugely successful producer of high quality feature films. So they were having a battle. Leonard Goldberg wanted a teenage monster movie, and that ended up happening. So I wrote, I think, two drafts when they were having a battle, and I saw that they were trying to make something that wasn't what I really wanted to make. And at that time, conveniently, I was offered Critters 2 to direct. So it enabled me to have done the work that I was proud of doing, created a lot of what happened in the film, and leave to do something else, much sillier.
Fair enough. Do you remember, just out of curiosity, because, you know, and famously, I don't know if a lot of people or fans know this, but obviously Mel Brooks was one of the producers on the movie, which is a pretty cool little side note to that story. Do you remember what script of yours they read that they were like, we want to meet with Mick off of this for?
I don't know if that at that point they had even read anything of mine, because I'd already worked on Amazing Stories. I'd already written Batteries Not Included.
So it was more just because you were coming out of the Amblin camp, you had some cachet that they were interested in trying to.
Yeah, I was already an established screenwriter at that point.
Got it.
And so that opened the door. And in those days, pitches weren't as detailed and deep as they are today.
Sure.
And, you know, I had a storyline that I was really excited about,
how does your agent call you and says they want to meet on the fly too, and then like you had to think and you came up with the idea, or did you have something in your back pocket? We were like, gosh, if I had ever gotten the chance to pitch on the fly too, here's what I would do.
I did have a story that I was pursuing in a different way that was going to be an original screenplay, and I went, wait, what if the child of Seth Brundle and Veronica Quaife with these powers under these circumstances? You know, it was a really great idea that's never been used, that perhaps I still will. But, you know, my first rewrite settled into a teenage fly too.
Right.
And that's what got pursued. Now, the next writer on after me was Frank Darabont. And then Jim and Ken Wheat were the final writers of the shooting script.
Right.
And they had been writers and directors on Young Indiana Jones, as was Darabont. And so.
Well, that actually kind of bleeds into our next question, so I might as well ask it. John wants to know, Mick, on movies you wrote drafts of but weren't the final writer on, how do you reconcile your feelings about the end product? What do you do or say if you're not happy with the final result?
Well, you know, that's one of the things you get paid for, is not just to do the work, but to be a part of a team. And Fly 2 is a perfect example of that. When I first saw they did a sneak preview of the movie, and I had not read the other writers' drafts. And as I'm watching the movie, I'm sinking lower in my seat thinking my career is over. And it was really depressing because it was such a high bar to meet with David Cronenberg's The Fly. Mm-hmm. And it didn't even try to be that movie, which is fine. And Chris Whalis did a great job directing and all. But so much of what I thought was the best parts of what I'd written were not there. And, you know, Hocus Pocus is much closer to what I wrote.
Right.
Just the ages were a little different. I wrote 12-year-old kids. They made it with 16-year-old kids. But otherwise, structurally and character-wise and the like, it was very, very similar, even though there were 11 other writers on it after me. But in that case, you know, there's still some things about it that I go, well, I wish it had had these, but it's proven me wrong by being such a perennial success. And you learn to just say thank you. You're mm-hmm. part of a team mm-hmm. that put together this movie, and how ungrateful and what bad karma to be grumpy about it and say, yeah, but if they'd only done it my way.
Right.
You know, it's right. You learn to say thank you and appreciate the career that you're able to have. You know, I'm able to make my living telling stories. And that's a dream I never thought would be fulfilled when I started. And to be able to be doing this, yes, it gets frustrating. And Joe, I know you've had your issues of being rewritten extensively as well.
Yeah, I just saw a cut of one of those pretty recently. And it's you know, it's not a fun experience when you realize just to the extent of what little is left of your script. But you know, it's you're right. It's you know, I certainly have my I like to poke fun at Hard Kill here and there, which is, you know, which is one of the ones that got rewritten ad nauseum. But, you know, at the end of the day, like the movie you know, it's still a Bruce Willis movie. It's still one of his final pictures, which is crazy. You know, it was number two on Netflix. It was, you know, it was and it helped put a lot of people money in people's pockets right before the pandemic, including my own. So I have no regrets about that movie whatsoever, regardless of what the critics think.
And you learn and you just continue moving forward and learning from your experiences and hoping that everything is better the next time. And you know, how to play that dance, to dance that dance with the studios and the networks and the all of the people involved to try to get your vision through as clearly as possible.
Yeah, there's a lot of when you're handing your script off as a writer, whether you're the first or second or third on, when you're handing it off into the process, you don't really have much control over what happens from that point. Yeah. You know, sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. You know, and that's just the nature, I think, of a collaborative art form, especially one that is so heavily ingrained in commerce. So.
And it's also how I became a producer, and as a producer became that tried to be the knight in shining armor to protect the filmmakers working with me on Masters of Horror in particular. You know, I was able to say, this is what these guys want to do. Don't get in their way. Let them do it and encourage them to do it and be there as a cheerleader and let them fulfill their visions. And we were able to see undiluted visions by the greatest filmmakers in the genre at the time.
And one of the most widely beloved horror series of all time. So, you know, maybe there's something to that formula that I wish other producers would pick up on, Mick, but
there are some who do.
Alas. Yeah. Yes, okay. There are some, and they're very in demand to work with. So, yeah. All right. Last but not least, Stuart writes, when you were filming the behind the scenes back in the day, what was the process of that? How much footage did you end up getting to then cut down to a reasonable length? And how much access were you given to the productions, casts, and crews?
It depended. Mostly it was pretty much the same. Remember, we were shooting 16mm film in those days rather than digital, so you couldn't just shoot endless amounts of it. And one of the reasons I was doing making ofs was because rather than the studio hiring an electronic press kit company to do it for $100,000, I would do it for $10,000. And was able to do it that way. Normally, we would get 2 days access to a production, so I would try to go over the schedule, the production schedule, and find, particularly like on The Thing, we had more than 2 days on that, but we had some stage work in LA at Universal Studios. We went out to Rob Bottin's location and shot his work as he's building all the creatures and the like. And we went on location for 2 days to Alaska, British Columbia, where they shot all the exteriors and shot the compound. But normally, like on Gremlins or the Goonies, I would be there for a couple of days, interview the people who were important, but try to choose days that would be visual. When I did Videodrome, I just kind of took what they gave me, and it wasn't necessarily the greatest, the most cinematic scenes that we were there for, but we got Rick Baker in his shop, and we got some good stuff, but it was on a very limited schedule, and we weren't making entire EPKs or electronic press kits in those days. These were like 8 to 10 minute making of documentaries that were given to TV stations all around the country or even the world. And so you'll see some of those pop up on Blu-rays special editions or the Fear on Film thing was one where we just used clips, but had me interviewing David Cronenberg, John Landis, and John Carpenter, all of whom who had Universal genre movies coming out.
I love when every 6 months Twitter rediscovers that video. Yeah, it's pretty funny. It's a good one too. Maybe we'll have to post it in appreciation for this episode. But
we will indeed.
Yeah. One question that I'm curious about hearing that, just to drill in a little bit more. You know, the producers, the studios, when they see the edit of the behind the scenes video, Did they ever go like, you can't show that yet, or like anything like was there ever like, take that out or change that? Or
I went in knowing the ground rules. So, right. You know, one thing about the thing in particular was Carpenter was the most slavish about not letting anybody photograph anything in particular. There were no stills of any of the makeup effects allowed to be taken. There were no camera photographers, publicity photographers allowed on set during any of the makeup effects scenes, so that the only shots of those, the creature shots or makeup effects shots that you see are frame blowups from the movie. And that was a very specific choice that Carpenter made, because there's a big difference in what latex looks like in real light and what it looks like when it's lit for a movie.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, all right, well, there you go, Mick. That's another round of Ask Mick Anythings. You survived.
Here we go. Yeah. So yeah, thank you, producer Joe. And everybody should by all means use our new email address of askmickanything@gmail.com. You can still use social media if you like, but this is the most direct way to get to me and Joe directly.
Yeah, send us questions at askmickanything@gmail.com or pizza. And you know, and you can still use Twitter and Instagram. You can find Mick at Mick Garris PM. On both respectively, and you can find me at Joe Russo Tweets and at Joe Russo Graham.
And still, we would love to get your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Yes, smash that review button. All right, guys. Thank you, Mick.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.